if possible, Mary's child.
So, one of the things when people create a movement, and the question is always defining the movement. So, how do we define Zionism? Living in Eretz Yisrael was way before there was Zionist movement. Like I said, it certainly is seen as being an extraordinarily positive thing. The question is, in relationship to all the other things. So let's say a person goes out to Israel and he'll have to work so hard to make a parnasa, he has less time for learning. He has a problem with this, with that. Question is, when you have to make a decision in life, you're always going to have a lot of things you have to ask yourself. Community that you like, work that you like, work that allows you a salary that you can live on, a place to educate your children, and time left over to learn. So question one of I guess religious Zionism put living in ancestral very much at the apex of religious achievement. The peoples that were not like, so for instance, the Talmid HaGro, Talmid HaBesh, they saw it as being very important, but they didn't see it as the be-it-all. And then so that has a lot of ramifications. When you start dealing with practical issues, should I make Aliyah? Well, is the only question is, will I survive, or what about other areas? Sometimes for some people in Ruchnius it's difficult. I think that's where there was a divergence between the different approaches to it.
If you take the Talmid HaBesh and Talmid HaAgra seriously, I think like anyone who probably the worst Aliyah case that could happen in 2018 is probably someone who's doing a lot better than Talmid HaBesh than Talmid HaAgra, in terms of all the you know, tzaras they're gonna have and all their concerns about parnasa and everything. So, do you think that should?
So again, in the perspective of that segment of jury, and we'll use the word charedi just as give us a convenient It's hard because when you're putting a label, everyone is different. So some fit later, someone. But if you told me that, so they saw Eretz Yisrael as being an extraordinary enhancement of a Ruchnistic experience. They did not see Eretz Yisrael as being possible to have a large scale living there. And therefore, the people that went tend to be like the Bnei Aliyah. And it was more like a big kolo, which is what it had become. Today, where it is viable, things have changed. It's very hard to adapt that model. I don't know. Reb Chaim Kanievsky tells everybody to come to live for a very different reason. If you go into him and you tell him you're having a problem, I know many people like that. Come to the neighborhood to live here. Everything will be okay.
What's he saying when he says that? Do we take it seriously?
Do people take it seriously?
Should people?
So a person who asks, you either don't ask, or if you ask, it's like a mamad of shach.
So what kind of dust, if we see it, how is it?
So if you're asking that, you're coming to somebody who's not going to ask many questions, he's not going to discuss it.
Okay.
He has a sense, he has a gosha. You trust that there's some sort of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is putting the right answers in his mouth. Let's take a Chassidish person. A Chassidish person believes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts the right answer in this person's mouth. I'll share a story, a personal story, with some you may have heard of, some not. I'm a real Litvak. I don't, you know, we tend to believe less and less in miracles and stuff like that. That's my Haredi part of the world. A year before I got married, I was a young bacha. One Shabbos, I had a roommate. His name was Rafal Shmulevitz. It's important to know his name for the story. He was a nephew of Chaim Shmulevitz. He was a Rosh Hashiva. He was my roommate. We were very good friends. And we said, we're going to Beirut for Shabbos. Sure, we went to Beirut for Shabbos. We had a place, a friend to stay by. And, we had a whole list of what to do in Beirut, who you go to. So I went into... So the stipler was one of the ones, you know, this was 1973. So went into the stipler, and we asked, so the stipler was deaf, so you'd have to scream or write something. So my roommate told him his name is Rafael Shmulevitz. Well, he told him, he read it, and he said, Reb Chaim's deaf. He said, yeah, how's Reb Chaim doing? How's his health? Is that fine? Then he turns to me and says, you also? So I said to myself, I'm going to have to yell 5 minutes to tell him no. My name is impossible to hear, to get through. And what's the difference? So I nodded, fine. Then I had a shtickel Torah prepared. So I gave it to him, he looked at it, he commented on it, it's that. Then we asked for some sforim, we went to the bar, we left, that was the end of the story. And so, a year later, I got engaged. And after the tznoyim, I was walking to my kala then, and she said, tomorrow going to Beirach. My wife's family, her mother's side is from the Chazon Ish. Her mother was a niece of Chazon Ish. Her mother's maiden name is Greinemann. Related to everybody at Chashev and Leva. So she said, we'll go first to the stipend, then we'll go here. So I said, yeah, I was by the stipend last year. And all of a sudden, it struck me, I had just become a nephew of Chaim Shmulevitz. My wife is a niece of Chaim Shmulevitz. And I also became a nephew of the stipler. I also became a nephew of the stipler. So it hit me. So I told it over to Reb Nachum. And Reb Nachum said, let me explain you what happened. He said, it's not that the stipler had a vision that I'm going to be a nephew of that. He said, when big people say something, it doesn't go to waste. And he said, I had a similar story, Reb Nachum told me. When he came to the mirror, Reb Leizudel Rosh Yeshiva asked him, who are you? He said, my name is Nachum from Truk, and my father's a trucker of Rabbi Trucker. So he said, Trukerov was a Talmud of ours. He's like a son of mine. You'll be my grandson. So he didn't, Reb Nachum told me, he didn't mean anything. Just meant us the Chavivus. He did become a grandson. He married Reb Leizudel's granddaughter. So he said, but his take was, it wasn't that as if the person had like a future vision of some sort or God of future. He said, when big people say things, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't, for a person who doesn't waste his words, doesn't say empty words, so a person who stalls so in such a way, I'm sure there's a Seyata Shmaya for it. You know, Yesh v'yesh. That's why Chassidim, there was a certain Rebbe, which Geza, famous one, he would answer only off the top of his head. And he said, when I answer the first thing that comes to mind, it's Seyata Shmaya and the Schus of the Chassidim. When I start thinking about it, it's me and my understanding. That's limited. It's whatever that... But there was a feeling. It's a certain level of bitachon living on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, that's what it is. So that's its validity. But I'm saying, when we go back to Zionism part, he tells everybody to come live. And it's more because it's Israel is more insulated than America. You're exposed to less. There's more kedusha and so on. So that's the feel of it. Yeah.
Changing topics. At the end of the Haggadah, we say we ask Hashem to shvoch chamascha on all like all the other.
It's a pasuk in Tehillim also, yeah.
Cool. So the question is: it sounds like we're worshiping like this Zeusian figure who is gonna like rain wrath upon the nice CVS checkout people. and so I'm saying, what are we really asking for when we're asking, or are we really asking for that, or is it like is it a history of things, or maybe it's not really them as we see it, or maybe it's the whole continent. Like,
so there present. Are here, and it says, Chazal say, let's take a, Chazal say, G'doylo nekama shenitna ben shtei shemos, keil nekamas Hashem. There are only two things, keil deos Hashem and keil nekamas Hashem. It's an attribute of Hashem that's between two words. So what exactly is Nekama? What exactly is Kel Nekama Hashem? What exactly we ask for Nekama? So let's understand a little bit about the mechanism of Nekama and why it's important and why it's Asa for us. Sikom is an Isser. If I can give a mashal, going back to the physics, we understand every action has an equal reaction. So when I push something this way, something pushes back against me, the exact amount of energy and mass that I moved, that's the amount of pressure it's doing the other way. Everything that has a metzias to it, its metzias reacts in the same way that was acted upon. Because if I'm a normal person, forget about the mitzvah and the chiyot Torah, if I have a healthy sense of self, if you do something to me, I even out the score. So when we see things that the scores are even out, we feel that's justice. And that's when we get very upset when somebody does bad things and he gets away with it. Somehow we feel that's wrong. He should have been suffering as much as the other person. And it's instinctive to us. And the reason is because it's almost as if the world, the moral world, is a balanced world. And therefore, if wrong pushes this way, we expect right to push back the other way. And we feel extremely unsatisfied. We feel something is wrong if it has been righted. The Kloisenberger Rebbe went through the whole Gehenna of the war, lost his wife and 11 kids, and at the end, when he was freed, everybody was happy or whatever, and said, "We won." And he was very depressed. He said, "You know, I expected that Germany not have a blade of grass left. That they lost is not enough for me. I can't fathom that so much evil is being punished with nothing comparable to it. There's a sense in us that if there's a God, and it's like a spring. If I pushed it this way, I expect it to snap back." The word nekama in Hebrew is kima, means to stand. The nun is a returning. It's like seiser nister. Nakum means you re come up again. And it's like those bobbing dolls, you know, you push it down, it'll come straight up. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been pushed around. So he's been maligned, he's been pushed around. The Jewish people have been forever, ever been, persecuted. Incredible. And so if the end of it is that the UN passes a resolution saying that Jewish people do have a right to live, that's not... Well, what happened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a few thousand years? Like, okay, so now they say, okay, you know what? We think we'll go on record saying you can have your country. That's nothing. The sense of whatever it is that the evil that you brought in the world should boomerang back to you. It there's something right about it. That whatever evil they've done, evil is a reality, and that should bounce back to them. We should not take the karma, and that's we need to do what we need to do, and that's it. We don't have the right for it. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Kein Nekamas Hashem. At the end of days, it's not the pshat that it'll be okay. But evil will have eaten itself up. That's really what it's about.
So are we asking for, horrible things to happen to people?
We're asking that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them what they deserve. I'll share a cute anecdote. Rav Meir Bar Ilan wrote a book called From Volozhin to Yerushalayim. And it's a very fascinating book. But he has there an anecdote about the little revenge that the Jews would get. You know, the Jews were oppressed, and the Tsar and so on. He said one day the Tsar became sick. And he got worse and worse, and he was dying, and he died, in fact. But as he was getting, as he was dying, basically... So the Jews called a Yom Tefillah. They needed to do it for PR, that the great Tsar is dying. So for PR's sake, they called a Yom Tefillah, and the notables of town, the governor, the ministers, they all came to attend the Yom Tefillah. So the Rav Darshan Divrei Hisoris before the Tefillah, and he said, it says in the Pasuk, Elokim, Lemelech Mishpatecha Tein, Oleven Melech Chasdecha. you should give the king your mishpat and to the son of the king your chesed. How come you have two different lashonos for the king and for the chesed? So he said, because the son of the king seems like a very fine fellow, the prince, the crown prince seems like a fine chap, but we don't know his record, we don't know what he's going to be like. So we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give mercy, can't ask for more than mercy. But the king, we know how wonderful the king is. We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give him what he deserves, not for mercy. And therefore we're all going to be espoused that he should get what he deserves, the Tsar. And he said, the notables all nodded their head, they loved it, it was a gewaltige part. They said, you know, everybody bit their tongue and they kind of, you know, nodded. But that was like the Jews' revenge on, you know. At the end of the day, it can't be that so much persecution, so much blood, the Catholic Church has on its hand so much terror and blood and evil. And what's it going to end with? Like a handshake with the Pope. We would like to see if there's an emes, and if there's mishpat in the world, and if there's tov in the world, then the ra will have to boomerang, and they'll have to suffer the ra. What we want to see is not the suffering. We want to see that the understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was there all the time is there, that nothing went to waste, and that people couldn't have murdered us and murdered and murdered and murdered. And you're talking about thousands of years, and without, you know, without anything happening to them. Yes.
So back to talking about action equal reaction.
Yeah.
In Mishnah Leah, it talks about how, let's say, if you master something, in like with yourself, your kids will have it easier. Like, if let's say I do something bad, there might be like a ripple effect, it might affect the whole Jewish nation. So why is it fair that like, my actions might affect everyone, including
so the klal is nations are judged as nations. That's why, for instance, an Amaleki can actually become a ger. We don't take ger, but they can be misgayer. As long as God judges nations, nations are the players on the. And that's why klal Yisrael. As long as you're part of klal Yisrael, you're part of klal Yisrael, and you get the benefits of klal Yisrael. You do suffer your own affairs, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges nations, and as long as you are part of the nation, you partake in whatever the nation prepared for itself. Yes.
So you mentioned the Catholic Church, and I think this is kind of what I was talking about a little. But it's true that in the past they've done lots of horrible things to Jews,
right,
and other people, but they have. It took them a while, but they have apologized for the Crusades. And the current Catholic Church did not do that. So at what point do we have to hold the current people that are in the Catholic Church accountable
I don't know. That's why only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can judge. I have no idea. And that's why human beings cannot judge, except for those cases that the Torah gave us. But in general, shouldn't that be a recognition that for 2,000 years, then the religion that we made is not a religion of peace, not a religion of goodness. Something's wrong with it. It's something along that line. I don't know. You know what? It doesn't seem as if the penance and the contriteness of it is really so fantastic. I don't feel that way. I mean, as recently as with 1948, that time when the Pope came to visit Israel, he didn't have the decency. It was after 48. Israel was a state already. I mean, he came from Mandelbaum Gate, and he gave Musa to the Israelis, that they're naughty people, and so on. He was Mamish. I don't. Yes, there have been one or two popes that have been actually, you know, decent people, but it's a small amount for a hierarchy, and I don't know. God will judge. I have no idea. It doesn't. But at least an understanding. We want to see a part of the Gilui. What's right is understanding. What happened to all that beer? Where did all the blood get lost? Yeah.
How do you know what they're trying to get you to be or something? Like, for Amalek, like, you want to wipe them out, but for the Nazis, what you're supposed to do? Like,
we have no. And that's what I'm saying. We really don't have. For you, there's law and order. which is important, like secular law and order. You know, people that steal, you want to make a stiff enough sentence so that people are deterred from it, and you want to keep away from the public. That we can do. Really giving a person punishment is only what the Torah said, because no human being has the ability to judge another person. So that's what we say generically. We say, you know, that all that pent up anger, let it out. In other words, the forbearance is not in its place. Show that you cared. Show that you were there. Show that it's recorded. That it didn't go in vain. I was last year in. I went in the summer to Lithuania. My father's grandfather was in Lithuania. He had a wife and children. He was an older person when he left. And I found a house that my father lived in. And I knocked on the house and the door. And an old lady answered. I was with somebody who spoke Russian. So wherever he went, I was in the mirror. I was, because they moved in 1965. And they don't know anything that was there before. That's like the first, as soon as they see somebody who looks Jewish, that's the answer. But she was an old lady. And as we were talking, she sort of, at some point she said, you know, then she told us, everybody look for the gold already. And it's gone. I mean, you know, the chances there'd be gold where my father lived was kind of slim. But you know, as he was talking, ask her this, that, she said, I know Jews used to live here, and I know that very terrible things happened, and I have nightmares at night, and I pray God forgive us. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. Then we went two or three streets over, and there was the house where they took Rabbi Chanu Wasserman to be killed. It was Rabbi Gudzinski's house. And we sort of sauntered into the backyard there. That's really where they were sitting. And there was a big Lithuanian guy there, rippling muscles. Didn't like the look of us. So he walked over to the back. There was like a shed with a wooden tree stump. And he started chopping firewood. I with a big axe. I don't think he needed firewood. I think he was sort of speaking a language, telling us, you know, don't get much closer because I've got one of these. It's hard, you know. So some people have that remorse a little bit. I don't know. Sorry, what did you want? Somebody? Yes.
So, Dara spoke earlier about the notion of mitzvot as a mechanism for making people better.
Yes.
I was kind of just wondering how that fits in with the notion of the Gemara of Gadol Mitzvot Ve'Oseh. If one was to take a more kind of like cosmic view of mitzvah and say like, oh, you know, there's like, there are points to be had, and a yid goes out and does mitzvot, they rack up more points than someone who doesn't have those kind of like, there isn't like that little box up there that needs to be filled with something. So it seems that if mitzvot are to make someone better, whether you're chayav or not, make a difference.
So let's use that. That's a good point. But let's use that as an understanding. If I tell you this person, a thought question. If I tell you so and so likes apples, and I tell you so and so must eat apples to survive, so. To which person are apples his essence? To which person is apple something that is his core essence? And to which person is it not? So the person has a choice to eat apples or not to eat apples. So that means those apples are not essential. The word essential is synonymous with vital, and it means the core of a person. For the other person, so let's give another, let's take an example. So, music. Some people like music and it's nice. They like playing an instrument and it's fine. Some people must play. And if they're not playing, they are going out of their minds. And the answer is, whatever you have to do, describe something that is essential to you. That's you. Whatever you choose to do, describe something you like. But it doesn't describe you. Mitzvahs, if we treat mitzvahs that if we want to, whichever mitzvahs Hashem gave us, that he says you must do them, it means that it's a core description of the person. Those mitzvahs that we do because we'd like to do them, they're an addition to the person, but they're not a description of the essential man. And that's the advantage of mitzvah. it's what it is to you.
It seems that often we like to describe the world in very technical physics terms. Punishment, everything is exactly like either each of you, ein kafar ein.
Right.
But in the next realm, we can't apply those physical and the one-to-one exaction terms. But is there any like reason to believe that that can't be? Is there any evidence behind why the next realm is just different?
The very fact that it's called the next realm, the very fact that our neshama is not physical, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not physical, mitzvahs are not physical realities, really. So that means it's a world that is different than our world. Olam Haba is not just, it's a different type of world, different type of mitzvahs. And since our core being, our neshama, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu are not physical, it stands to reason that that's not physical either.
But when nothing's physical, is there a way to give any evidence for it?
Let's see how we relate to something. Let's take an example of something. You have a computer and a monitor. Now, whatever goes on inside the computer looks nothing like what you see on the monitor. But the monitor is a very close measure of what's going on inside. So somebody who understands can tell you what program is running as you see it. So here we have something is an accurate reflection of something else, like the Chazal that speaks about the Mishkan being a painting. And it teaches us, because it's an accurate reflection, point by point, every pixel on the screen relates to some sort of instruction in the program, but it's a very different type of thing. So a person who knows both can tell you what program is needed to produce this picture, and look at this picture, he can tell you what program is producing it, and he's sort of living in two worlds, a little here, a little there. So the world that we have in this world, love, hatred, horror, fear, yearning, ambition, all of those are something more. Let's say something like ambition. And animals don't have ambition. Animals have survival instincts. And no animal will look to have, like, I have the biggest collection of acorns in my little hole. It's like it keeps gathering acorns. If that's what it's program, it keeps gathering acorns, and then maybe it's geared to stop when the thing fills up. That's it. The idea that I want to do better, and maybe instead of eating acorns, we can try to make something else out of it, some other product, acorn burgers or something. That doesn't. An animal never goes past itself. Ambition is a driving force to get more than, because we are more than. No matter what a person does and gets, he's not happy, because we have something more than us. There's a famous Chazal which expresses this. Chazal say a mashal, a king's daughter fell in love with some farmer, with some, country hick. And she's crazy about him, she married him. And this poor guy, it comes home, and she tells him, I'm bored. So he tells her, there's going to be a quilting contest next October. Wait until the quilting contest. And she says, I am bored. And he says, well, there's going to be an apple butter making event. And no matter what he come up with, she's bored out of her mind, because she's beyond that world. And it's the same with the neshama. No matter what I give it, that's why people are restless. People don't feel. One of the points that gets people to think about Yiddishkeit, religion, Yiddishkeit, is, are you happy? Like, no. Is there anything bothering you? No, but I'm just not happy. Something's missing. Something's missing. I'm missing meaning. What is that? The answer is, there's something more to us, and no matter how much bagels we'll eat, it's just not going to do it. So there is a sense in us, there's more to life than this. There's something more than that. And that's a gateway to life beyond. Yes?
I haven't done that question a little bit. I've had people ask me before, like, how do you know Judaism is the right religion? Because they didn't try the other ones. And I'm like, it's just an inherent, like, emunah type thing. I don't really know how to explain it to you.
Let's go to that question and let's visit that question a second. Again, this is a broad topic and so on, but let's take this question. Imagine you're living in Silver Spring, and it's pleasant, nice, and someone says to you, "Are you so sure?" Yes, someone says, "Why live in Silver Spring? Nice. I mean, are you sure it's the nicest place to live? There must be places that are nicer." The answer to that is possibly, but what's the solution? So I'm going to have to live in Louisville, Kentucky, and Miami, and Topeka, and Los Angeles,
and Mali.
Good. So he's and on and on and on and on. So it's a balanced person doesn't make a decision like that. So a balanced person goes like this. Either I am very unhappy here, it's really bad, so I start looking for someplace else, or I happen to be on a visit somewhere else, and it's, wow, it's so much nicer. I say, I must want to move there. But the idea of exploring everything, if you have to explore every religion to find an emes, you'll never find it. There are Christianity is not Christianity. There's Catholicism, there's the Orthodox Church, there's Protestant sects, and they all firmly believe each one else is going to hell. So you've got to give everybody a fair chance. Then we've got Islam, and in Muslim you have Sunni, and you have the Shiites, and you have Sufis,
Amadja.
I see you've done some exploration. And then we haven't even gotten to the Eastern stuff. And we haven't got that. And same thing studying philosophy. There have been 1,000 philosophers and 1,000 philosophies. So at the end of the day, for that thing to be more than just a cop-out, it requires a sephardic understanding. Why? So if I'm living next door to a Christian fellow and I say, wow, this guy has got it. I mean, this is amazing. That prompts an honest person to look for it. Or if I have tremendous satisfaction where I am, that prompts. But if not, it's ein l'dav sof. That doesn't have, there's no chachma to that. Type of approach.
Is it a fallacious question?
What?
Is it a fallacious question?
It's not a fallacious question. It's loyme chokhma shaltet. So you're not, that's not a reason. You cannot choose. The same way if you're dating somebody and decide that maybe you'd like to propose and somebody asks you, how do you know there's not a better girl out there?
Right.
The answer to that question is a misleading question. It's not leading to what you, if what you want to do is marry to do a shidduch, then the question is, maybe there's a better girl, is the perfect question for not ever getting married. But it's the same way, how do you know this religion is right, is the perfect reason to cop out of religion. It's not to look for emes. So a question is like in science, a good question leads you to an answer. And in philosophy, the type of question is, how do you know we're not fantasizing everything, is a nonsense question, because it leads no place. It doesn't really lead any place. There has to be some sort of a question is a probe, and it's meant to guide you someplace. Yes. Wait, maybe somebody else.
Yeah,
somebody said that. Yes.
I'll go back to the topic.
Okay, what?
So I'll go back to.
Are you related? You look like brothers.
Yeah,
brother.
Yeah. Brother.
I'm saying myself. You know. Okay. What's your name? I'm sorry.
My name's Mendy.
Cavillio.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway.
Oh, wow. Cavillio.
Cavillio.
They used to have all the Bhagavad Gita Shiva always.
Exactly. Yes.
What?
Yeah. Anyway, so I was talking to somebody earlier, and I remember talking about the significance of Eretz Yisrael. And they mentioned how all the, Nevi'im had Nevoahs in Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
So it's such a special place, and it kind of just, like, got me thinking for a second. I'm like, wait a minute, wasn't like the first Nebuah not in Eretz Yisrael, and Moshe had thousands of Nebuahs in wherever, in the desert, and I just could think of a bunch of instances where there was Nebuahs outside of Eretz Yisrael. I just wanted to know
So there are different reasons given for that. It says by Yecheskel that he had a nevuah on the har kvar. So Gemara says kvar means already. It's once the nevuah started at Yisrael, it can continue. Because this was a trip to Eretz Yisrael, it's not the physical location, it's because this is on the road to Eretz Yisrael, nevuah could be chal already. So it's also centered around the fact that it's headed towards Eretz Yisrael, but it's working with not because physical, okay, but just like by Yecheskel, once he already had nevuah before, it could stretch even when it was chutz la'aretz.
Did it also happen because he was next to a river when that happened? I remember like reading a commentary that also had to do something in
the Har Kvar, I don't know, but the Chazal say Har Kvar Shekvar Hoya. That's the Lashon Chazal.
Okay.
The river was named Kvar, which means already. Maybe one more question, then yes. You were quiet so nicely all the time.
Like the four elements and the Rambam brings it down a lot.
Yes.
And how everything's made up of it. How are we supposed to relate to that? Like the molecules.
So the Rambam uses the concept of four elements that the Greeks saw as the cornerstone of the physical world, which was fire, water, earth, and air. That was the model the standard model of the world at the time. So the Rambam uses it only in the sense of describing the world. The Rambam says he has two parakim where he says, I'm going to paint you a general picture of the universe. There's nothing wrong with saying he was using the science of his time. It's not relevant to any halacha. And we don't understand it that way today. And that's the end of that. There's nothing there that's in any way significant. The Rambam is using it just painting a painting. The Kabbalah's firm do use it. And I would like to try to give it some understanding that's relevant today also. Those four elements really correspond to four states of matter. You have solid, liquid, air, and energy. So we don't look at it as elements of building blocks, but we look at it as states of matter. And the fact that Kadosh Baruch created the world in a certain way, that there are four states of matter, means that those things are reflecting a certain inner reality. So that can be translated into reality as we know it today, and it has deeper meaning as well. That's it. And the Rambam only used it as, the Rambam says, I will draw you the basic map of the world's on. And, it stands where that science stood, and if not, it's not important. Any other diagram you draw is fine.